Welcome to TLU, everyone. Thanks for coming. Teachers, if there is a sign-in sheet by the cookies and refreshments, if you could please sign in and give me your email address, that way I can contact you about future talks in the physics department. It'd be a great way to be able to get a hold of you and let you know what's going on here. My name is Sean Hilbert. I'm a professor here at TLU, and I am very proud to be able to introduce our speaker today. Dr. Herman Bottolon is actually my advisor in graduate school. He was a great mentor and friend, so I'm very excited to have him here. He got his master's degree in 1987 in physics at the University of Leiden. Did I say it right? All right, sweet. In the Netherlands. And this one I'm really going to butcher, so I'm sorry. He got his PhD in 91 at the University of Utrecht.
Could it close enough. Very nice.
Also in the Netherlands. He had a postdoc in SUNY and Stony Brook, New York. And also in Austria, and then came to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in 1996, where he is still at. He is now a full professor. He has gotten $2.5 million in grants in his career. He has been a recognized teacher at UNL. He's been an American Physical Society Fellow in 2009 for his work with the capacitive direct effect and Aronoff Bohm effect. And he is also has a part of a movie on the double slit experiment with electrons. That's run by the Perimeter Institute. Teachers, you can download this for free. It has a lot of great educational information there for your classes. So you can see some work that he's done there. He's going to talk today about science fiction becoming reality. Thank you.
Okay, well. Well, I doubt I can live up to that very nice introduction. So thank you, Sean, for inviting me here, and thank you all for coming. They started something like this. He said that there is some public lecture, and he told me this in the summer. And then I said, oh, I could talk about some of the research. And he said, well, maybe it's not so appropriate. So I, at this spot in my enthusiasm, said, oh, I can talk something about science fiction and science, which I have to apologize. I've never done this before, so this talk is new, and it will not be very smooth, right? But I'll try to do my best, and I'm wondering if I'm sane to actually give this talk, but that's okay. So I'll work with me here, please. All right, so let's get this thing on the road. So there are three topics I'm going to talk about. One is teleportation. One is, so every time you see in the top corner a figure that looks like this, we're still in the teleportation part. If I start saying two difficult things, then at least you see the little picture, you know where I am. Here there is faster than speed, faster traveling, than the speed of light, right? And then you have here, this is a picture from Star Trek where I think two of them are with magnetic shoes at the bottom of their spaceship, right? Which is kind of not anti-gravity at all, but it's the only thing I thought would remind me of that particular topic. All right, so let me first ask you a question. Who in this room actually thinks that you can teleport? So please raise your hand if you think you can teleport. Who think, well, and I presume the rest says not, right? Okay, that's interesting. It's an interesting question, right? I'm just kind of gauging the audience to see what you know about this and what you don't know about this. Okay? Good. So if you would want to teleport, right, you have two options, it seems. Because if you look at what happens, a person disappears somewhere and reappears somewhere else, right? So the options you have would be dematerialize the object, send the object, and rematerialize it. Somehow you got to break it apart and then, right, put it somewhere. The other thing you could do is scan the object, destroy the object, send the information, and build the object. You may worry a little bit, why would you want to destroy the object if you can scan it, send it, and build the object, right? Might be painful or whatever. But it's kind of weird because if you wouldn't destroy the object, you would every time copy the person, you would get another science fiction story, right? It would be amusing. But that's what you would have to do to mimic this process, it seems. And, of course, the way you would like this to happen is something like this. Because, of course, here I have a picture of my lab. Oh, wait, stop. Stop. I don't have the sound here. I want the sound. Hang on. Give me a second. It's hard to see. Probably here. Well, let's try it again. Is that the right one?
Okay, I got it. There it is.
Quality is not too good. Hang on, I'm gonna play that again. This is kind of interesting that, you know what? I'm going to go out of this thing and I'm going to run that movie separately because somehow in the PowerPoint it doesn't does such a good job. So here, let's try it again. So you can do it, right? I can do it. It's not so hard. As a matter of fact, my grad students insisted on playing with what is video editing software, and I was kind of embarrassed, but they told me I should show this, so I did. And it's kind of fun, but that's the idea, right? That's what we would like to have happen. And if you, of course, got to do it and you got to work with option one, then you have a little bit of a problem because consider just the sending the object part. If you consider that, what do you need? Well, say your body weighs about 100 kilograms or 200 pounds or something like me. And then let's teleport in 1 second from orbit. Say you take a particular orbit. Doesn't need to be near orbit, but say 600 miles up. Then you could figure out how fast, what the minimum velocity is you need to get to that point, right? And thus you could figure out the energy, the kinetic energy that you need. And this is what you get. If you work that out, you get about 20 kilotons of TNT, which is the same as the Trinity test, right? That was the first nuclear explosion in the United States. What is it, July 45 or something like that? That's a lot of energy. So imagine that you have kind of a barrel that you're sitting in and this thing goes off and you're shot towards something. That's how much energy you need to do that. That's not going to be good. And the minimum acceleration you need is about... this thing, got to get used to this. The minimum acceleration is about 10 to the 5th G, which of course means that the forces on you would be enormous and you would be immediately pancaked. So there is no way that we know of course, overcome that particular problem. So that type of teleportation is not going to succeed. Of course, you could take option two, scan the object, destroy the object, send information, and build the object. And let me forgo the idea of how do you destroy the object or rebuild it. Let me just think about the part where you send the information. Consider that. Well, so if you have a body weight of, again, about 200 pounds, and then you think about how many protons and neutrons and electrons in there, so that's a one with 29 zeros about, right? And then you think about that, how accurately would you want to know where your atom is? Well, say an atom is about the size of an angstrom, 10 to the minus 10 meters. You have to place that within about, 1 meter. So that tells you the relative accuracy, how well you need to know where that particular thing is. And so that gives you, I keep on pushing the wrong button. Come on. It's annoying. It's close together. That's about 1 billion, billion terabytes of data. So in other words, if you have your A drive 3 terabyte disk nowadays, right, that has about 5 millimeter thickness in a nice laptop, so those are fairly thin. And thus, if you stack them all together, you could circle the sun at the Earth radius about 1,000 times. That is a lot of data you need for one person, so you would have enormous difficulty. And you could even say, suppose even if you could do that, do you really... If you would teleport, am I just the sum of my parts? Right? You might worry about things such as your soul or whatever. Right? It's a frightening prospect in many, many ways. And if you want to know more about this, there's a wonderful book out that came out maybe 10, 15 years ago by Kaus, The Physics of Star Trek, that had all kinds of estimations on the Star Trek phenomenon where you can figure out, well, is this possible or not possible? And it's really neat. So, but it seems that the two ways we can think of really prohibit us from teleporting something as large as you or I, right? So most of you, when you did not raise your hand, if you were thinking something like this, yes, you're right. Now, of course, on the other hand, if you look here, this is a report from November 2012 from MIT Technology Review, and they collect things that are hot in the news, and you look at that, and you see, hey, here's a first teleportation from one macroscopic object to another. So what is that about? Well, what that is about, if you would read it, then it turns out, there is a University of Hefei in China, right? They did this particular thing, and what they really had was a little glass cell with floating rubidium vapor in it. You can even cannot even see that. And then they put light, they had light coming out of this cell that moved to another cell far away, and some of the properties of this light were teleported from one place to the other. Okay? That's what this thing claims, and that is what a particular type of teleportation is about. And of course, what are the words you typically see when people talk about teleportation? They see this in the context of, you know, the quantum internet, and then these, this atomic bunch is kind of, you store there some information, right? And then you send it further. And so they have visions about having a, you know, a quantum memory and a quantum router and a quantum internet. Everything you say with a normal computer, so you have a bit and you have a quantum bit, you have a computer, you have a quantum computer. But teleportation is at the heart of being capable of letting these systems communicate with each other, which would be a requirement. Okay? That's what people are thinking about, and a lot. At some point, I dabbled in this with my group a little bit. This was picked up by India's national newspaper among some places, which is kind of nice. And then they talk about something that we did, which is, we stored a single bit of quantum memory also in one of these vapor cells. And it was kind of a neat thing. And so at that time, I was kind of interested in that. However, I found that the technological difficulties were so vast and I had other interests that I didn't pursue this much. But there's lots of people in the world working on this stuff. Yes? It's highly amusing. So what is this? Instead of teleportation, it is quantum teleportation. So what is this about? Now, and Sean, you have seen this in graduate quantum too, right? So if I would be in a graduate teaching my graduate quantum class, then we would go through a derivation of this particular circuit. But you need a couple of quantum mechanics classes at a physics department usually first to do it. So join the physics department here and figure all it out, right? They would love you if you would come here. Anyway, this is impossible for me to explain, but I will say some things about it, maybe something that it's not, because that may help at least to think about this a little bit. Another maybe interesting thing to say about this, that this was first done in 1997 in Anton Seiler's room in Innsbruck, and I happened to be next door to the place where he did this. And the second to last author, Harald Weinfurter, was actually the person I used to go skiing with in the Austrian Alps. Wonderful thing. And they were excited at the time, but I don't think even at that time they realized, doing this research, what a big buzz that would create. And if I had my thinking cap on, then I would have immediately joined that group, which I had the opportunity to. But I found my own research was much more exciting, which was a mistake, right? But you never know ahead of time. This is always the thing with science. But a wonderful place, and they did this. So what is this stuff? What do you need here? So there's two people. Let me quickly go over this, regardless that it's probably too technical. There are three pieces of information, let's say three particles or three things you need, maybe three socks you need. I don't care what you think of at the moment. And then you need something special that is really a quantum mechanics thing, things that happen usually with small objects, where these two particles are entangled. And I'll say that word again and try to describe a little bit what it is. But if Alice and Bob share one of these, or they make together that entangled pair, then one takes one of that pair and one takes the other one. Then there is a correlation between it that goes beyond any correlation that we usually think of. And that capability allows them to later on, when Alice does something, she measures something about this property, that by the measurement she changes this other particular thing actively, so that that information can be, in that sense, even instantaneously, kind of move to another location. And I have to be very careful with the words I use, because you can't really move information instantaneously, but it's kind of. I'm struggling to find here the right words for that particular, what it really is. So you need entanglement. And in the end, the thing that is going to be teleported, which is this particular state, then shows up. So first Alice has this, and afterwards, when this is destroyed by a measurement, Bob recreates that state. And they actually don't even have to know what that state is. They never have to look at that particular thing. It's highly strange and foreign. It really feels a little bit different than the teleportation you see in Star Trek. All right, so Entanglement, I will tell you what it's not. It's not a strong classical correlation. What is a classical correlation? That is something like this. I go to a light switch, I turn it on, lights go on, turn it off, lights go off. That's a perfect correlation, right? If you had, there was a paper a long time ago that talked about this a little bit, and that was Bertelmann, and so they talked about Bertelmann socks. And there you had this thing that this person puts on. It's a funny habit of putting two different color socks on. So as soon as this person walks behind a wall, emerges from behind a wall, then this sock, if you see it's pink, you know the other one is not pink, right? So immediately you know that might look like entanglement, but it's not. It's a classical correlation. Quantum entanglement is a stronger correlation than that. It's really weird. And that's that resource that everybody is using in quantum information, quantum computation, and all that stuff. Okay? That's about the best I can do there, which is pretty lousy, I know that. But so what is it good for? Maybe we can answer that. Well, here's another piece of news, which is interesting. May 2012. This is a place, maybe you can see there's a kind of a laser beam in it, where they teleported properties of light between two islands in some island group in front of North Africa over a distance that is almost about 90 miles. Now that's kind of considered to be another major breakthrough, because this idea of having this quantum internet materializing, it would be very nice if you could teleport between the ground and satellites, right? And so as soon as you make a line of sight teleportation over a distance of about 90 miles, you reach about where the lowest satellites orbit, and thus you could do it. And so there's really this vision out there that people want to realize this. And it's happening right now as we speak. Okay? Very interesting. And is it really going to happen ultimately? Nobody knows at the moment. All right, good. That is interesting. Now, you may have noticed that this was done by Canada, Germany, Austria. The previous one was done in China. So you might have the feeling that, are there still Americans doing anything, right? Well, here's something that Americans do. Let me switch to faster than light. Stanford researchers managed to get a good look at 10 elves. So that's what the American, they look at elves, right? And it seems to me very strange that we look at, no, this is really serious stuff. It's really incredibly neat. So let me tell you about elves. Who's ever heard about the elves? Have you already looked this up at some point? Anybody? No? New elves? It's not the elves in the fairy tales, but it's a different elf. It's an atmospheric phenomenon, okay? So this is a lighting phenomenon that is in our upper atmosphere. And there were reports even by astronauts that looked down. They filmed these things and they saw lighting of circles expand by about 200 miles in less than a millisecond. If you calculate that, you find out that it expands faster than the speed of light. So when that was first observed, this was an incredible buzz. Gee, something is happening that is going faster than the speed of light. And it was observed and filmed. They say, what is going on there? Right? And of course, here they say, you know, although the elves appear to spread faster than the light, analysis of the physics behind the elves demonstrates there's no particles actually move that fast. So Einsteinian relativity is not violated. So let's see what this is about, because actually we can understand this. So can you go faster than light? Can you go faster than light? Even if I have said that. Probably not, right? Most of you would probably not raise your hand on that one. So, oh gee, have I a funny movie or is this, let's see, what movie is this? Maybe I'll go, what? Yeah, let me go off this one again. Oh gee. Again, this is one of those that my graduate students. So, what we would like to do? No. I may not be. Hang on. Come on. It may not be. Yeah, this is actually movies of elves and sprites by the University of Alaska. Very nice. Oh, come on. Not so good. I'm sorry, I apologize for my computer cannot handle all the data, it seems. And it's funny because when I tested this, it can, and then sometimes it doesn't. So let me go off again. I do want to show you that movie. Let's see. Where can I find it? Here. If I stop it here for a second, I hope you notice in the meantime what the scale of these events is. If you look here, this is from 50 kilometers altitude to 90 kilometers altitude. So these events are about 20 miles tall. So these happen above lightning storms. So if you have lightning storms, for every lightning strike that strikes down, above it is a much larger multiple lightning phenomena. There are sprites, and there are jets, and there are these elves. And so these occur. It's kind of interesting because it's taken with a camera that runs at 1,000 frames per second. So these, the sprites, last just a couple of milliseconds, and that's why it's so hard to actually document them. And there were even in the 70s already pilots that reported such phenomenon, but then only it took to about the 90s for these things to be documented. So it's really neat, and they're real events. So now let's just keep on looking, because I think the next one may be one of these elves or sprite halos. So that's much less spectacular, right? Just floop, big flash, and that's kind of a disc that you see from the side, from the edge, all right? I think. Hi. Hang on. Stop. Stop. Can we please stop? Hi. So I hope you saw that. So that's amusing. So these events really exist. Uh-oh. Please. 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 Oh. This is terrible. But hang on. Anybody ever suffer from this? Yes. Sorry, guys. Come on.
Do you want to use the desktop?
No, it should be fine. We just tested this twice, right?
Yeah, well, should in R. It's different.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, guys. Technical difficulties.
When you power this guy,
just power it up for it. Oh, I hate that. Okay, let me just speak. I mean, Sean will try to get it going. So you have these sprite and elves, right? And thus, the interesting part is that there are some slides there, but let's just draw it on a blackboard. We'll switch to the blackboard. So imagine you have a cloud base here somewhere, and you have the ground, and you have a lightning strike. Now, this sends out to the top, it's sometimes kind of a shockwave. Now, you have to imagine that there is then a kind of a shockwave that circularly expands, and it can expand itself at the speed of light. So this thing goes that way at the speed of light. Yes? So now, if you have a upper layer of an atmosphere, because you have all these layers, so think of the ionosphere that is maybe 100 kilometers or 60 miles up there, then as soon as this layer breaks through a plane, so if a sphere breaks to a plane, what shape do you get? Yes, I heard it, right? Circle. You get a circle, right? If you have a sphere going through a plane, you get a circle. Now, then you see a circle. Oh, you got it?
Yeah.
Ah, thank you. So, hopefully we just can keep on going with this thing. All right, there we go. There comes the sphere. You see? And it breaks through that plane, and you have an expanding circle. So now you wonder how fast could that circle be expanding. And that's, by the way, on one of these pictures of these elves again. And so if you look at this, now I'm looking at the side view of that particular thing. So imagine that you're going, you know, from that first point breaking through that surface to the next one. Now, if this arrow indicates that this thing expanded with the speed of light, then whatever this crossing point between the sphere and the plane moved further in the same time than this sphere expanded. That means that this must go faster. Yes? So indeed, you can get phenomena that look like they go faster than the speed of light. And that's exactly what people see. Okay? So that's perhaps interesting. And there you have a mock-up picture of people. The other way, it's not limited to that phenomenon. It actually goes much further. So here's something, a little flash movie that we made. Suppose you put two patterns like this on top of each other with the same, you know, regularity, same periodicity. Then I can make this entire dark or line them up or something like this, right? Now what I can also do is, of course, put an angle in between them and get little bars. What you could also do is run these things so that they're going to move, like they're little waves that move forward. So I think of this as waves that move to the right, and the red dots kind of indicate the speed of the waves here, and these red dots indicate the speed of the waves there, right? Nothing too spectacular happens. Now, if you change the wave, the periodicity a little bit, you've got already a pretty big effect. And if you change the speed of both of them a little bit, now you start seeing something perhaps a little bit interesting. You're getting patterns. What do you call them, right? They have certain names, but it's kind of like a shadow pattern. And that shadow pattern starts moving with a certain velocity if you follow that. But you may notice that this shadow pattern is overtaking those little red blobs. So suppose these were two colors of light, two wavelengths of light, both propagating close to the speed of light. We adjusted their velocity just a little bit, and you overlap them. What then happens, they get interference patterns or overlapping patterns that themselves can move faster than the speed of light, like this pattern kind of indicates. Just like here you have a line breaking through another line, and this propagates through it. So it's a cross point, right? Here you again see nothing else than simple cross points moving over each other. Yes? Make sense? So, I hope so. Now, I don't even need this to be at an angle. You could put it like this, and then you can indeed see that's called a group velocity. You have the official name for these things is that these lines move at a phase velocity, while the shadow pattern, let's say, moves at a group velocity. And the group velocity can be much faster than the phase velocity. And the phase velocity is the speed of light. So now, what you can even do is make pulses. So suppose I do not take one frequency. Well, if I take one frequency, I get the red wave, right? If I take two frequencies, maybe people know that you get a beat phenomenon, much like if I don't know if some of you play violin or some guitar, if you want to tune two strings together, right? Then you, what do you do? You can, what is it? You pick the which bar, the fourth or fifth bar or something like you pluck two at the same time and you listen for a beat note. For those of you who play guitar or things like that, so this is a beat note. Now you can put many others there, and you can build out of many of those wavelengths. You can build a little bit of a packet. Okay, let me do it. Hopefully, I'm getting slowly successful if I do it right. See, I'm making one big pulse. For those of you who like that, Fourier transforms is here. It's at work, right? Okay, so et cetera, we've done it. Now, what we can also do is make that pulse move, because if that's a pulse of light, it can move and still have the same phenomenon we saw earlier with the two waves. So let's try to give that a shot. Yes, it still works. Every time I push the button, I say, please, please work. All right, so we can start, and what I can do, this is just a pulse that would be unaffected. So all those waves move now at the speed of light, and now I get a pulse of light that just moves at the speed of light. Yeah, not a big deal. But if you change each one of them just a little bit, it's kind of interesting. Then the pulse starts to change a bit. And I'm changing then the velocity of each wavelength in that pulse just a tiny bit. And then you get funny stuff. What you get is things where what you have to do with your eyes, you have to follow this pulse and then see where's the envelope going. Well, here's the envelope, right? You follow the top of that big pulse. And what you can also do is follow an individual peak. Now, what is faster, the individual little peaks in there or the envelope? The envelope, right? The envelope overtakes the little peaks. The little peaks move at the phase velocity, the speed of light, and the blob moves with the group velocity, which is now faster than the speed of light. Yes? That's what that thing says. Can you really do that? Can you make pulses of light move faster than the speed of light in this sense? Okay. Let's take a look at that. Let me quickly switch to here. Yes, you can do that. Here's, for instance, a news article in Physics World in July 2000. Laser smashes light speed record. Nature paper by a person by the name of Wang. And this was done in Princeton in the United States. And so, indeed, here they reach 310 times the speed of light with a pulse of light. That's amazing, right? So, yes, you can do that. You can go fast speed of light, but you have to be careful. The deal is if you attempt to send information with that technique, it fails. If you attempt to send energy, which is completely non-obvious to how to explain that, but if you try to do that, that fails too. So we still cannot send either particles or energy or information faster than the speed of light. But you can get phenomena that go faster than the speed of light. It's delicate. It's confusing. It is something that probably requires more research where people need to think hard about, gee, is this maybe good for something? What does this exactly mean? So it's different. Yeah, it's more subtle than what we usually think of going faster than the speed of light. You can also, by the way, if I would have changed how those waves move, you can also make the pulse much slower than the speed of light. So let me go one back. So here is it's interesting. Here is an experiment that was done by Lina Howe and Michel Lukin at Harvard. And they have some, and there's a comment here from Eric Cornell, a Nobel laureate, wonderful guy. And he describes how you can take a pulse of light and put it in a little cell filled with this rubidium vapor and make it very, very slow. So this is data that we took. We've done this too, just to confirm, because when I saw that first, I said, really? Can you make light that slow, up to 10 meters per second? Yes, you can do that too. It's extremely strange. I mean, you start with a pulse that's about 2 miles long, and then the front of end hits that piece of glass, kind of almost stops. The rest follows it in. It is all in the cell, and then suddenly the front end comes out, vroom, and comes out of it, and then Eric Cornell compares that to a train going in a tunnel. You see it disappear, and then suddenly the front comes out again. It's a very strange phenomenon, but they use this to, you know, control pulses of light and trying to, again, it's almost like routers of information. That's what here the idea, what they think of using it for. But it's all based on the same idea that you just have two lines that go over each other. If one moves at a particular speed, say the speed of light, the cross point can move faster than the speed of light, or if you change the angle, can go much slower than the speed of light. That's really what's going on. So it's the same understanding as you would have for these elves. So elves, slow light, fast light, is all the same physics in that sense. Okay, it's maybe interesting to realize that. And that's in the news every now and then, so that's kind of a nice thing. Okay, and here's an experiment. And this doesn't require many millions of dollars. I mean, maybe half a million. Okay. It's okay. But this is, this is a particular experiment where we also slowed light because it's nice to do. It's fun. Good. So could you really go to warp, though? Because that's, of course, a different question, right? That would be much more fun. Now, this is, again, one of those movies. Oh, my goodness. Oh, gee. I'm going to immediately jump out of this because I'm not going to even attempt to drive it. Do this in there. And this is, again, due to my grad students, try to illustrate what warp speed is supposed to be about. I'm slightly embarrassed.
Yeah.
So this is supposedly me in the spaceship, and you notice how the wind blows in the spaceship, right? I mean, yes. Makes no sense at all. Here, warp is obviously achieved. I mean, and they kind of twisted my arm. I had to show this, so again, I apologize. It's extremely embarrassing. All right, let's keep on moving. So that's what we would like to do, right? Or somewhat different. But actually, it's interesting. If you look, you know, even in such places as Wikipedia, and, you know, be careful if you're a scientist in the physics department here, then, of course, your instructors will tell you that this is not a referenced or a refereed source of information. Nevertheless, lots of us use it to, you know, get acquainted with things. Not so bad. I love Wikipedia, to be honest. But there is a paper which is published in regular journals in 1994 by Michel Alcubierre. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. But he actually showed that there is a solution to Einstein's field equations, right, that looks like this, at least in two-dimensional space. There's a three-dimensional space equivalent. And it's something, you have to think about this as space is distorted. In general relativity, we often think that masses distort space. So if you have the Earth, it makes a dent in space, and other masses kind of fall into that dent, in a sense. Okay, I'm doing the best I can there. And so the deal is, you could imagine that there is a kind of a funny mass distribution where here you have kind of a dent, so you put a lot of mass here and that puts a dent in space. And here you have kind of what they call exotic matter that makes a bubble in space. Now if you have this thing, this by itself moves through space. So the funny thing is if a person would be inside this area, then relative to space, that person doesn't move. So never breaks the speed of light. But since that person moves together with this deformation of space, which can go much faster than the speed of light, then relative to the stuff outside, that person is moving faster than the speed of light. Okay? This is something that the Einstein field equations actually support. That's what this gentleman showed in a theoretical paper, you know, quite a while ago already. Yes? So this is rather amusing. Now, of course, this is extremely problematic in its own right. So, you know, it turns out that some other people wrote papers on this, and occupants don't have control over the front of the warp, so warp bubble, so which is kind of bad, because then you cannot steer or control this thing, so people on the outside have to control it for you. Well, it might be still okay. And then there's some kind of a radiation effect associated with this that is so intense that anything in the inside would be killed, which is also not particularly good. Somebody else showed that. Also theoretical paper. And then, of course, the warp bubble requires negative energy density, which means something like this. You know, it's here is something attractive gravitationally, but here is something repulsive gravitationally. So you got to, how do you do that, right? It's amazing. Well, maybe not so crazy. I mean, you probably have all heard, maybe at this point, of dark energy. Who's heard of dark energy? Some of you, right? So nowadays, the going idea is that our universe seems to be expanding at an accelerating rate. And the thing that people are looking for is this source of dark energy that's responsible for this. But that is exactly like the type of exotic matter that Alcubierre needs in his warp bubble. Okay, one candidate is this. The vacuum field. The vacuum field is whatever it is. It's something that we know in physics that has actually a negative energy density. So at least something exists of that nature. So maybe this is not completely hopeless. Perhaps at the particle level demonstration, right? Not for human beings like you and me, because you need crazy intense amounts of energy that we just cannot control in any way, shape, or form. Okay. On the other hand, it's maybe not that insane to think of things that can move faster than the speed of light, even when it's matter, because actually we're not violating, the great idea of this thing is that we're not violating Einstein's law, because actually never mass or energy moves locally faster than the speed of light. It could even be locally here at rest while an entire thing moves through space. It's really a nice way to overcome the no-go theorems. Yeah. Good. Okay. Let's, how am I doing in time? I still have a little bit for the third topic, perhaps, right? Okay, so can you shield gravity? Who thinks you can shield gravity? Yes, some of you think you want it, right? Yeah, I want it too. Actually, I have one grad student working on this, believe it or not. I have always difficulty saying this, maybe not in a public audience, but if it's my peers, right, if it's professors that determine if I would get funding, I wouldn't talk about this. But here I can talk about this. Okay, so first something simple. Do photons fall? Does light fall? Who thinks light falls? Please raise your hand. Who thinks light does not fall? Why does light not fall? Has no mass, right? That's what you say, things with mass fall. Well, on the other hand, you may have all seen the demonstration of a penny and a feather, right? You take a penny and a feather, you evacuate the tube with air, then you drop it and they both fall at the same rate, right? All things fall at the same rate, independent of mass. If I then take the limit of mass goes to zero, why wouldn't it not fall? So actually it might still fall. Things that are very, very light or maybe even massless might still fall. So even in our old-fashioned Newtonian classical mechanics, we might expect light to fall. And of course it was Einstein with his theory that calculated that level of falling was wrong by a factor of two. That's all. And it was a big prediction, and that's actually the one that made him famous. It's not what he got the Nobel Prize for, but it's certainly something that made him famous. And yes, photons are deflected by the sun, and that's, of course, predicted by Einstein. So if you would look, this is almost a century ago, if you would look from the Earth towards a object that's far out in space which sends out light, and you look just by the sun, you'll find that the object appears to shift. What really has happened is the light is deflected by the sun. And indeed, the prediction of general relativity is exactly right there. Okay? So that's neat. So photons fall. Okay? So there's other photons. You do not just have the photons you can see. In physics, we talk about other photons too. You all know maybe that charges, like charges, repel, right? And opposite charges attract, right? At least for hopefully with electric charges. So if you know that, then you say, gee, how come there is a force between charges? What we say in physics is that these forces are mediated by virtual photons. So there's a kind of, there's real and virtual photons. Whatever that is, doesn't matter, they're photons. So imagine now that you have here a charge and photons run away from this. And then then what you could have is you could put another charge there and it feels a force that is repulsive along the direction of that line. Yes? If this would be a negative charge, then you feel an attractive force, no surprise there. Okay? But what happens if you would put this in a gravitational field? Now this is my bad simulation of bringing in a massive object, then these photons would fall too. Right? And if they fall, what happens to the forces? Well, here's a force that has an upward component. But keep in mind, what force does this one feel? Attractive or repulsive? Attractive, right? So this one has an arrow this way, which also has a component upwards. So funny enough, if I have a positive and a negative charge, and I put them together, and you put them in a gravitational field, there's an upward component on both of them. So isn't that amusing? Most people don't think about this. But the funny part is, you can think of it another way, which is more well-known, which is this. If you have two charges and they repel and you push them together, they're, let's say, the same charges, it takes energy. You dump energy into the system. And I bet you everybody knows one physics equation here. What is the most famous physics equation? E is mc squared, right? So if you dump energy into a system, what happens? It gets heavier because there is mass equivalent. Now, in this system, they're not repulsive. These things are attractive. So by the way, if you let them go, it kind of, if you have a positive and negative charge, they attract each other, and this takes energy out of the system because they can do work on something else. If it takes energy out of the system, it should get lighter by E is mc squared. So you have already two arguments that tells you that this system should get lighter in a gravitational field. And you could compute what the deflection of light does and the mass does. And it's amusing. Indeed, Well, I just put the equations there. I won't explain them to you. But here is the, in a simple way, the mass, the energy argument. And here's the force argument. And it'll give you exactly the same answer, which is an indication that it's supposed to work. This was, by the way, already known in about 1970-something by Tim Boyer at the City College of New York, a wonderful gentleman. Gave a talk there at some point. It was wonderful to meet with him. And he publishes the American Journal of Physics. It mostly goes unnoticed, that paper, because at the end they say, well, there's no way that this you could see this force because it's such a small effect. But nevertheless, it's a gravitationally induced force that opposes gravitation. Now, at some point I thought, well, what about this? It's kind of an easy idea. You take your charge and you put you put lots of charges around it. You just make the effect bigger. Now, if you just think of the energy argument, you wouldn't know where to put those forces. But if you take the force argument, you know it's symmetric between the positive and the negative ones. And thus, there should be a significant gravitationally induced force on this. If this would have been an electron, so negative charge there, then you would have to put this at about 1 million volts, because the rest mass energy of an electron is 0.5 million volt, to get here a gravitationally induced force that opposes the gravitational force and exactly can balance. That's a prediction that we can easily make from this. And so that's kind of a fun thing. And of course, you shouldn't take this. I mean, it's not this, right? Here is something that is an interesting movie that hopefully you've seen at some point. It's Levitation of a Frog. This is real levitation. I mean, this is not anti-gravity. This is done at Nijmegen University in the Netherlands, where people... Yeah, you know, well, the frog is okay. I hear some people... that the frog does something like this means that they're typically happy, so I'm told. If they go, oh, like this, then they're not so happy. If they're like this, they're not so happy either. So this... Okay, so the frog is in it. I should have taken a picture of that. I didn't. It's a big magnet. And it is a magnetic. In the center of the magnet is a little bore, and there's a big magnetic field pointing this way. The magnetic field opens up, and as the frog is placed in there, little magnetic moments in the little magnets in the frog are induced that repel the magnetic field, and it's just two magnets repelling each other. That's what it is. But you can do that with a frog at a scale, but it requires something like. If I remember correctly, something like 50 Tesla. No, it can't be that big. Maybe 10 Tesla. Huge field. And it would be fun to do it with human beings because it would work for us too, and it seems to have no damage on the animal whatsoever. However, nobody's made a magnet with this big of a bore with a field that exceeds 10 Tesla. That's hard to do. I mean, you have enormous forces in these magnets, but that's not unthinkable. It would be nice to have that type of levitation, as opposed to vertical wind tunnels. If you know, it's another form of levitation in a sense, right? It's all kind of neat. But this is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking, of course, about something where the force on the object is induced by gravity itself. So that means if it is like that, then if I take that shell far away from the Earth, there's no gravitational force and no gravitationally induced opposing force. But now I just bring it towards Earth. You get a gravitational force and an opposing gravitationally induced force, and they might balance, at least for a single electron. That's far cry from an actual object or a frog or a human being. But after all, it's fun to think about these things. And thus, let's see if this movie works. Then you would get something like this, right? This would be the hope. Again, with bad video editing in this case, you can get the effect. All right, never mind. I can't show that too much. So anyway, so I have to thank two of my grad students, Maria Becker and Eric Jones, for doing the video editing on those movies, and I promised I would show them to them. Interesting, at some point we had an REU student, Jessica White, that is actually from here, also come work in the group in 2010, and there are the other people that work in my group. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions for Dr. Balan?
I like questions.
Any questions?
It gives people a chance to think. Oh, there.
So, earlier you were talking about how two light streams were put together and they were moving this way, another moving this way. that when they intersect, that they will move faster than the speed of light.
Yes.
Correct. So, we can't put things on that faster.
Yeah. You would hope to use that phenomenon to slide something forward, right? Yeah, this is a thought that I've heard from other people too. Like, you could think of that light pulse and use something to surf the front of that pulse, right? That's kind of the idea, I think, right, you're talking about. And it's true, certainly, that you can use laser pulses to push particles forward. That's true too. Now, however, as soon as you start pushing a pulse, then as soon as this thing would start, that particle would start approaching the speed of light, then what happens to its energy? Its energy, according to Einstein, goes to infinity. So the thing becomes immeasurably difficult to move, right? So you would need an incredibly large force to do so. And since you do not have the capability of making infinitely large forces, this thing will kind of fall through that pulse and lag behind. So yes, your idea is cool, but if you try to do it with a massive particle to make something move, you can still not break the speed of light. But it is a good idea.
So is that also kind of like when you have a gas in a pressurized box and you superheat it and it starts going really, really fast back and forth, it just goes through it?
Oh, no, this is okay. No, it's not the same thing. Interesting. That's nice to make associations there. That's good. I like that. Think about the speeds involved in a hot gas, in a typical hot gas, right? So what is the speed of, you know, nitrogen or the vapor that I used in my rubidium cells? You typically talk anywhere from a couple of hundred meters per second to a couple of thousand meters per second. Speed of light, of course, is 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, or say 7 times around the Earth in 1 second. The velocities are so much vastly larger that with heating you don't get anywhere near it, except maybe if you think of the interior of very dense stars. But then it's not just a heat associated with motion, because then you usually get other processes, radioactive processes. You get a plasma, you get a soup of stuff, which is much harder to describe anyway. But still, we have seen nothing yet at all that either mass, information, or energy that can go faster than the speed of light, regardless that are phenomena faster than the speed of light. So although, this is by the way very interesting, that what you're trying to do, right, is try to break a principle. And the same Nobel laureate I just mentioned, Eric Cornell, he gave at UNL at some point a talk, and he said, and he directed it to the students, and I love what he said. He said, there are lots of no-go theorems in physics, things you can't do. But that's exactly where the fun is, because the fun of trying to break those no-go theorems are, of course, a great, you know, exercise in trying to understand things. And if you get super lucky, you might break one, and then there's the next breakthrough, right? So I love what you attempt to do. There was another question there?
Yeah, question. You talked about the gravitational shielding, and I missed the spot. You can't shield it, but what you're saying is you can oppose the force, the typical opposing force, to make it levitation. It's not shielding at all.
Well, hang on. This is the point I was trying to make, that it's a little bit different. Yes, it's somewhere in the middle, in perhaps. It is not something where I take a charged particle, you put electrical plates, you turn on a voltage, and you oppose the two forces. Because after all, if I would take that system and remove the gravitating force, this thing would accelerate through, right? This system is the opposing force. Although it's electrical, it is gravitationally induced. So without gravity, that force goes to zero.
So it's not like Lenz's law with electric field. It's gravitational.
That's true. But that's a very different flavor.
Maybe
I mean, do we know? I'm sorry?
Maybe the rate of fall is so slow you don't recognize it. We did a demonstration with a magnet and copper tube. You see the fall here, it might be so tiny you can't measure.
Yeah, true too. Yeah, that's a good point. Now, you can estimate how big those effects are. And these effects for any system that at least these other authors or myself have investigated, the effect is always too small, can't see it, except for things such as free electrons in an enclosure. Now, there was one experiment in the 80s in Stanford where people reported to see the free fall of an electron. And it's kind of interesting because I follow up on it because I was curious if I could do the experiment myself to demonstrate this effect for the first time. And then I talked to people like Carl Wieman, Nobel laureate at Colorado, who worked at that time there, to say, hey, was that experiment right? And he said, no, that he didn't believe that. Jerry Gabriels, guy at Harvard, who's just the antimatter trapping, he worked he knows about that shielding phenomenon. He also says, no, the shielding is not right. So it's kind of a debated issue. Did people even see the free fall of an individual electron? That's a requirement. Then on top of that, you would have to put this in a 500,000-volt enclosure, which in principle would be possible, and then see if the free fall is affected to the point that it actually stops. Certainly, this is a tall order, but it's kind of within the technical capabilities we have. And that would be fun because that would be the first time anybody shows a gravitationally induced field effect. There are other ones where the binding energy is measured. There is one collaborator that wrote one paper with Dave Pritchard at MIT. He actually measured that if you put these two systems together, this binding energy, he just took a molecule, then he measured the separate parts by making them go through a loop, right? And then you kind of feel the we don't like to say the centrifugal force, centripetal accelerator, whatever. I don't care. So feel that. And you did that with the separate parts and then with the thing together and measured the binding energy as an inertial mass. So the inertial mass effect has been seen, but the gravitational mass part has not been seen. But it's really an interesting question, but it's a different category. It's not direct gravitational shielding, but kind of an indirect fashion. Fair enough? Yeah. So it's a good comment that you made. Yeah. Other questions?
Any other questions?
No? Oh, you were ready to get it to applaud. Sorry.
Last chance. All right. Thank you very much.
Sure. All right, good.